or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chautauqua, Mooneyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, January 20th, 2022. On tonight's show, a special edition of Upstage, I'm going to play for you excerpts from the Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast put together by the folks at the Saint-Ambroise Montreal Fringe Festival this past year. My guests tonight include director of Le Lab Fringe Buzz, Sarah Grenier-Laforce.
Trying to find a way to connect with the fringe audience because, COVID makes it hard. But also we were trying to find a way to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Fringe Festival. And so the podcast just appeared like a great idea to do that, to connect with people who have been part of the history of the festival.
The creators of the very first Fringe, Nick and Chris Mora.
It was nice to have a place that English theater could dabble in interesting things and try new things. And the Francophone community took some time to come around. But, you know, as that started to emerge, it became a really interesting place and time in theater.
Early Fringers Elsa Bolam and her daughter Allison Darcy.
Somebody joked at the time, I think we were having a meeting of the various companies, and somebody joked that if a bomb dropped on the building, English theatre would be gone.
And Khalil Ashanti, an artist who kickstarted his career at the Montreal Fringe.
Who are these people waiting for? And they all had the review. Like, the people were waiting in line, waiting for me to sign the picture of myself on the front page of the Montreal Gazette. And I was like, who is that? Oh, it's me.
Before we begin, I just wanted to let you know I'll be hosting the Sunday at the Siegel Conversation this Sunday, January 23rd. It's to complement the upcoming show Pandemish from the Yidlife Crisis Guys. Tune in this Sunday at 11 at the Siegel Center's YouTube and Facebook pages. We'll be talking about Jewish identity, culture, and art. In spring 2021, I was asked to take part in a brand new project, a podcast titled Le Lab Fringe Buzz. It would be a bilingual audio series put on by the Montreal Fringe Festival, both a way to mark its 30th anniversary, but to also connect a community during another pandemic Fringe season. The Fringe is a form of theater festival that takes place all over North America and in the UK. Individual festivals are set up locally, and the Montreal Festival takes place every June. Here, artists enter by lottery, and they can do whatever they like on stage, no intervention or say from organizers. Tickets are cheap, the shows are short, and artists keep all their earnings with a small fee for festival costs. Volunteers provide most of the manpower. It's a great place to start out. If you're just beginning your career, you can take part even if you're not a professional. And some performers travel the country and the world performing at various fringes. The DIY ethic come to life. I hosted 4 episodes of the podcast in English, and artist Véronique Raymond hosted another 4 in French. Tonight and next week, I'm going to play for you some excerpts from the shows I hosted. It was created with support from Arts Unite, and you can always check out the full episodes on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, with the title Le Lab Fringe Buzz. But first, I want you to meet Sarah Grenier-Laforce. As a theater publicist, she's usually the one behind the scenes, setting up interviews, coordinating messaging. Sarah is in charge of public relations and partnerships at the Fringe Festival. And she's also working on a graduate degree, with her focus being inspired by her many years with the Montreal Fringe. Sarah also captained the creation of the festival's podcast, Le Lab Fringe Buzz. We spoke earlier this week to talk about the show, its future, her research, and Fringe in 2022. Welcome, Sarah, to Upstage. Thank you for taking the time. So before we get into the podcast and how much fun this was to make, I want to hear about your relationship with Fringe Festival. What was your first year that you came to the magic of the Fringe?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here. Fringe has been so important in my life for a very long time. I started working for the Fringe in a long time ago as an intern. And basically after that, I did so many different positions in my actual.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. The show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Chauchage, Munayang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording from home on Thursday, January 27th, 2022. On tonight's show, a special edition of Upstage, I'm going to play for you excerpts from Le Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast put together by the folks at the Saint-Ambroise Montreal Fringe Festival this past year. It was hosted by me. My guests tonight will talk about the rich world of opportunity presented by the Fringe for emerging and underrepresented artists. Writer Marie Barlizzo and performer Julie Tamiko Manning on the opportunities at the Fringe.
As a person of color and as a person who struggled to get, my work out in the Montreal theater scene, without the Montreal Fringe, I wouldn't still be here after 18 years. It took about 18 years to get produced.
Because that's where I got my feet wet. And the non-curatorial nature not only meant that anybody could be on stage, but it also meant that any story could be on stage.
Comedian and host Trana Wintour.
I just got to feel like it was me holding court, you know, and like really just doing exactly what I wanted to do in the way that I wanted to do it, and that was it.
Choreographer and Jane of all trades, Helen Simard.
It's hard to say that there's one role that's a favorite role, because I think what's beautiful about Fringe is that it gives a chance to people to participate in live performance in so many different ways. So you're not just an artist or just a spectator. You have the chance to blur back and forth between these roles and appreciate the festival from all sides.
And finally, journalist Pat Donnelly on covering the early days of the festival.
Fringes are inhabited by mavericks, but the creativity of it and just the miracle of the putting on the show. And I saw shows that so much imagination, you know?
But first, theaters have a reopening date. Finally, they and other venues like arenas and cinemas will be allowed to resume operations at half capacity in just under 2 weeks from now, Monday, February the 7th, 2022. It's the second phase in a gradual reopening plan as the province recovers from the sweep of Omicron last month. Many spaces had shows and events planned for January and early February, so the scramble is on to reset and push ahead with the performances that are ready to go. The Centaur has pushed back its live shows to March, and The Seagull is presenting a streaming version of a show that had been slated to go live this month. Ironically, that performance is Pandemish, a comedic look at Omicron and the pandemic in Montreal, presented by Ellie Battalion and Jamie Ellman, the comedic duo behind Yid Life Crisis. You can stream that show at home starting just after the show, actually, around 7 o'clock tonight. The price is $18 or $36 for a household, and it starts this evening and continues until Monday, January 31st. You can head to seagullcenter.org. So in the coming weeks, I'm hoping to look ahead to theater's reopening plans. But for tonight, though, I saved for you a remix of a project I worked on last year with the folks at the Fringe Festival. I did this last week. Maybe you caught some of my conversations with the festival's original founders, joined by the current director of the festival, as well as a mother-daughter duo who were present during the early days. So just a little backstory, in spring 2021, I was asked to take part in a new project, a podcast titled The Love Fringe Buzz. It was intended to be a bilingual audio series put on by the festival, both as a way to mark its 30th anniversary, but also to connect with a community during another pandemic fringe season. The Fringe, of course, is a form of theater festival that takes place all over North America and in the UK. Individual festivals are set up locally, and the Montreal Festival takes place every June. Artists enter by lottery, and they can do whatever they like on stage. There's no intervention from organizers. Tickets are cheap, the shows are short, and artists keep all of their earnings with a small fee for festival costs. And volunteers provide most of the manpower. And some performers travel the country and the world performing at fringes. It's the DIY ethic come to life. I hosted 4 episodes of the podcast in English, and artist Véronique Raymond hosted another 4 in French. The show is created with support from Arts Unite, and you can always check out the full episodes on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen with the title Le Lab Fringe Buzz. We start this evening with Marie Barlizzo and Julie Tamiko Manning, both Montreal-based artists. Marie is a writer, Julie is a performer. And when they had first graduated from the National Theatre School and started looking around for opportunities to work, they found that their options were kind of limited. We discussed the value of a non-curatorial art spaces where artists can call the shots. Marie and Julie shared this mutual feeling that no stories were being told that represented their life experiences. And for both of them, the Fringe's value system provided a space where they could focus on telling their own stories.
My name is Julie Tamiko Manning, and I am an actor and theater creator and playwright and mentor and facilitator and fringe audience member and lover, and yeah, yeah, that's me.
My name is Marie Barlizzo. I'm a playwright, screenwriter, playwriting mentor, and I'm also an instructor at the National Theatre School and mother of 2. That's me.
Marie and Julie, so nice to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We wanted to speak with you, obviously, because of your connections to the Fringe, but also to talk about what it means to have this festival have a non-curatorial approach and what this means for cultivating stories and bringing different stories to the fore. To me, it's a very theater kind of word. For someone who may not be familiar with it, what does non-curatorial theater mean to either of you?
For me, having this approach to programming the Fringe allows for a more for equality. Everybody has an opportunity to produce their show through the lottery, and without the Fringe, I don't think I would have a career. So as a person of color and as a person who's struggled to get my work out in the Montreal theater scene, without the Montreal Fringe, I wouldn't still be here after 18 years. It took about 18 years to get produced in Montreal. So it means a lot to me.
I graduated in 1991. And back then, the landscape was even more homogeneous, I'll say. And I found it really difficult to get cast in anything. So I did mostly children's theater, which actually led the way in non-traditional casting. And so the Fringe was my experience getting on stage. And I think, same as Marie, I would agree with you that without the Fringe and Geordie, I don't know what kind of a career I would have, because that's where I got my feet wet. And the non-curatorial nature not only meant that anybody could be on stage, but it also meant that any story could be on stage.
I'm wondering, Marie and Julie, if we could talk about, you know, why was it so hard to get those stories out there?
Between 2004 and 2007, when I really decided to work in Toronto, I really felt that there was very little options for me. And what really nailed it in the coffin was basically, I applied for a grant. And back in the day when you'd get a grant back, you would get, like, you'd have to send so many copies of your play to the granting body, and then they would send it back. And what happened was basically my worst nightmare as a writer, was I got the playback, all my plays back, not only the rejection, but all these sticky notes that basically said that the only reason that my play was really awful, and that the only reason why artistic directors that worked with me were supporting me were because I was a person of color, and they were jumping on the bandwagon to help me, and that I had absolutely no talent. For me, I was heartbroken because I felt that there was not a lot of opportunities in Montreal at the time. But at the same time, when I would walk into the room of different theaters, I would think, was it you on that jury? I was an emerging playwright, not even like 5 years out, and still with very little opportunity in this community. And I felt that I had to leave because I wanted to know that I was good enough, whether or not I could make it, because otherwise I would stay here and I don't think I would ever have the opportunity. So I had to make that decision very quickly to find my community, because I didn't feel like I had a community here. And that has changed so much, you know? It's changed so much with programs like, the Artist Mentorship Program, the Playwrights Unit at Playwrights Workshop Montreal, so there's a lot of changes that have happened. But during that time, I felt that I couldn't even go to anyone. I felt shamed as an artist. And I felt that maybe it was true, and I didn't want it to be true, and that's why I had to leave.
Yeah, that's such a... it's such a terrible way to support your community. Like, that's just not the way that you want to talk to anybody. An emerging artist, like, that is a sure way to get someone to leave town.
Did being part of the Fringe also help you network and connect with other people who would be in a similar position to you, feeling like those doors were still closed?
I think that it allowed me to find a community, to find the theater community. And it also gave me, as a young artist, it gave me an understanding of producing, actually. I think that that's something that is really incredibly important for every artist to know, is how to produce. And Marie, I'm sure that you can speak to this, is you learn how to produce your own shows, not because you don't always want to produce your own shows, but you have that skill under your belt. It's a really important thing to know.
The Fringe has helped me so much. I can't even begin to tell you, not only as a producer, but also as a playwright, and just making my connections in Montreal stronger, but also outside of Canada, outside of Montreal.
Why is it important to you to tell your own stories and to put them out in the world, or make space for them?
I think it's really important to tell Asian stories, but in particular Filipino stories, because Filipinos in general are very... we're very present. We're actually the third, or if not the first, immigrants right now. We're the largest immigrants who come to Canada in the last census. But yet our stories are not told, very little stories. And in fact, the last, aside from the Little Marie superhero, the last Filipino story that was told in Montreal was in 2005. It was Miss Oriented, that Tisri Dunia has done. And so for me, that is, and that also reminds me of, in World War II, a million Filipinos died. They were killed, and that's dismissed. We're a big backbone here in Canada. And yet when you look at the stories that are being told in the theaters, in film and television, Filipinos are not really present. since our stories are not being told, you know, our writers are not being developed, our actors are not being developed, our directors are not being developed, you know, the next generation are not seeing themselves on stage, you know, and their stories reflected. So they think that they don't count. And that's why I want Filipino stories to be told.
One of the biggest reasons why I want to put Japanese Canadian stories on stage is there has been a lot of assimilation. So for Japanese people who immigrated before World War II, they went through internment, the internment experience, and from that lost so much pride and knowledge of identity and culture and language and belief. And so my desire to reinvigorate that in the younger and not even younger generations, but generations that are older than myself, don't see themselves reflected on stage. Very much what Maria is saying about Filipino people not seeing themselves reflected on stage. And so that equals erasure for them personally and for their experience. But also, the younger generation understands that their personal history is very connected to a Canadian injustice, they will be able to understand the injustices that are happening in the present, and they will be able to stand up for people who they're not necessarily connected to. And I think it's really important for people to know where they come from and how the communities that they come from, feeling of responsibility, and a desire to fight for justice. But it's a direct indirect reason why I think it's so important to put my personal story on stage, and for me to be able to see Marie's personal story on stage. Because if I don't see her story, I can't stand up for the Filipino community, and I want to be able to do that, because it's not a fair, equal society if we don't stand up for each other.
So the other thing that's really important to me is, like I said, the future generation. So for me, the children, the ability to see themselves and their stories and have this imagination, you know, when you see that, you know, my show, The Little Mighty Superhero, Filipino kids saw that. Their parents contacted me and said, my God, my kids think that they can now write their own stories. So this really excited me and made me feel like it's fantastic, because they can dream and they feel like they can have, I mean, they can one day become writers and tell their own stories. That's really exciting. And that, for me, if I even one child does that, I'd be so thrilled, so thrilled. And I also want to say that Julie Tomiko Manning inspired me to be in the theater. I saw her show. She was in a Daniel McIver show, and it was the first time I ever saw an Asian person on stage before, and I said, it's possible. It's possible in Montreal.
This is the importance of community. Marie is a part of my community, and I appreciate you lifting me up that way, Marie. And I hope that now I'm getting all like emotional, but I hope that I lift you up in that same way. So thank you so much for saying that.
Thank you, Julie. I love you.
I love you too, Marie.
That was artists Marie Barlizzo and Julie Tamiko Manning. I'm Sarah De A. You are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Tonight, I'm featuring parts of Le Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast series I co-hosted last year. It was produced and published by the good people at The Fringe. Still to come this hour, Helen Simard on wearing many hats at The Fringe, from spokesperson to venue manager to artist. I want to play for you is Trana Wintour. When the comedian, singer, producer, and writer came to the Montreal Fringe, she was ready to treat audiences to her first hour-long comedy and music show. She told me about how Trantasy was a culmination of her artistic career to that point and a playground for experimentation.
So Trana, by the time you had come to Fringe, you had been performing all around Montreal and been developing and refining your act. And why did you choose to do the Fringe at that point?
It was still pretty early, like, in my performing career before I did The Fringe. Like you said, like, I had definitely been fine-tuning my comedy material and building all of that up. And I was only into it 2 years before doing The Fringe. And I just thought from everything that I had heard that The Fringe would be a really good place to sort of increase my visibility in the city as a performer and just get my name out there a bit more. And of course I love doing stand-up, but I love doing shows where I get to incorporate music and storytelling without the pressure of like having to make people laugh every 20 seconds, you know? I like to be able to do things that cover more emotional ground. And so the idea of like doing a one-woman show at The Fringe just seemed like the way to go.
And on top of it, you're not like waiting off on the wings and you're not being timed. Like,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. I just got to feel like it was me holding court, you know, and like really just doing exactly what I wanted to do in the way that I wanted to do it. And that was it.
Queen Trana holding court. How would you describe Trantasy?
Well, it's a one-woman show and it's basically comedy, storytelling, music. At the time, because I was so early into my career, the musical numbers that were in that show, like I just got these like karaoke backing tracks from like iTunes. But now I have the luxury and honor of like having live musicians with me on stage, and that really takes things to a whole other level. So Trantasy was sort of like the foundation of everything that came afterwards.
So you're testing things, you're trying things out. Did you find anything that you ended up discarding that like didn't work, and you learned that through that immediate audience feedback?
No, actually I think the opposite happened. Like I actually incorporated things that came about in the moment during that Fringe run. Like one example, like I remember there was one audience one night that for whatever reason, they were just a bit more difficult to draw out in terms of getting a reaction from them, getting them to be more engaged. And so just off the cuff, I told the audience the story about this time that I was in New York going to see Bette Midler on Broadway. And that night, Sarah Jessica Parker was sitting in front of me And I saw Sarah Jessica Parker eating a Kit Kat bar, specifically one stick. Like in the middle of the show, she pulled a Kit Kat bar out of her purse, broke off one stick, and then literally put the rest of the Kit Kat bar back in her purse. And that was always a moment that had like really stayed with me. Like I'm such a big Sarah Jessica Parker fan. I couldn't believe that she was like right there. And so at this Fringe show that one night where the audience was like a little bit tough, like I sort of just ditched my script and my usual material and just started telling that story. And then that got them. And then I ended up refining that story and keeping it. And I used it as like my closer for my comedy sets for like a decent amount of time after that. So with that particular Fringe show, Trantasy, like I really got to also be improvisational and in the moment and just riff with the audience. And then the things that really connected were the things that, you know, I kept using afterwards.
You mentioned about wanting to build, now we would say brand. I don't know if we were using the brand, the word brand as much back in 2015, but to get your name out there and your persona and your face, and you certainly got that. You were on the cover of Cult. So seeing your face and having it on this physical copy of a magazine that everyone's picking up, what was that like?
Yeah, I was shocked because I remember in sort of, I don't know if you would call them tutorials or like workshops that the Fringe gave us in terms of what you need to put together in terms of press materials for your show, like the do's and don'ts of what kind of photos you should have, all of that stuff. Like, I mean, I'm always like a studious overachiever. So like, I really, you know, took all of that advice in and did the best that I could to deliver on all the things that were sort of shown to us that tend to do the best, you know? And I think that especially when it came to the photos that we included with our materials, I think everyone's goal is to sort of get that Cult cover, but I didn't even think about it as a possibility, honestly. Like I felt good about the material and the images that I'd put together, but I never thought that there was a chance. I'm still a big fan of Cult MTL. I was a fan of The Mirror before it closed and evolved into Cult MTL. And as a former West Islander who used to like do these long commutes to get to school, like The Mirror was like my Bible, like reading The Rant Line, just reading basically The Mirror cover to cover and then reading Cult cover to cover. So it was, you know, it's a publication that really holds a special place for me in my heart. So to be on the cover was very surreal. And I remember when I found out that the issue had gone to print and that it was now distributed through the city, like I ran out of my apartment, like going place to place, like trying to find it. And then when I did find it and I saw it, like I actually cried. Like it made me so emotional to see that in person. Cause I think even though I can't say that it was a goal, but it was definitely a wish, you know, for that to happen. And so like, it was truly a dream come true moment.
Did you pick it up at the Debonair or the cafe and like turn to the person at the cash register and go like?
No, I did not do that. But very randomly, I had a friend like a year later who was apartment hunting and someone had turned my Cult MTL cover into like a clock face. So they like made a clock out of it. And so my friend was apartment hunting and they were just in this person's random apartment and there was a clock with my Cult MTL cover on the wall. So that was cool.
Wild. I love that.
Yeah, that was cool.
So what is Trantasy in 2015? You know, where does it stand in the trajectory of Trana Wintour in terms of what it's meant for your career?
I think, again, like it was really foundational. Like I think it introduced me to so many people. And it's really been the taking off point of everything else. But I think that it was a really great introduction in terms of, you know, me sort of meeting the Montreal audience in a way that I really got to show that audience like who I am in sort of all of my dimensions, which I don't always get to do when I'm just doing like a straight up stand-up comedy set. You know, I think that Trandacy allowed me to really show the spectrum of what I can do on stage.
What's coming up next for you? It always seems like you have 10 different projects going at the same time.
I mean, I just miss performing so much, and I don't know what that's gonna look like or what shape that's gonna take. I haven't started planning it yet because everything still just feels so uncertain to me. And so I don't think I can deal with that heartbreak of like starting to plan something and then not be able to do it. Cause I mean, that's what happened last year. Like I was going to do the Toronto Fringe with a new show called Dear Alanis, which is like my comedy musical tribute to Alanis Morissette. And I was so excited about that. And it was like a miracle that we got in that lottery. And then of course it didn't happen. So right now I'm really just more focusing on more writing projects. So I'm developing a scripted comedy show right now, one in English, one in French. That's sort of like my biggest project right now. And of course I do a podcast called Chosen Family with CBC Podcasts, which is an ongoing project that I love doing. So I'm really grateful that despite losing live performance, which for me is the heart and soul of everything that I do. Like I love all the other projects that I get to work on, but my soul is the most alive when I'm on stage. And that's really the thing that I not necessarily care about the most, but that brings me the most meaning and fulfillment.
That was Trana Wintour, comedian, singer, producer, and writer, speaking with me on The Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast I co-hosted for The Fringe last year. I'm bringing you a remix of those conversations again for you tonight. You are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. I'm Sarah J. Still to come, former Gazette theater critic Pat Donnelly on the massive task of covering a sprawling festival with shows wildly varying in scope, quality, and size.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Choreographer Helen Simard has done just about all the jobs you can do at the fest, besides running the whole show. Her fantastical Pink Floyd-inspired dance show, Dark Side of the Moon, won rave reviews and fans a few years back. But she's also performed, managed the outdoor venue, and even stepped up to be a spokesperson over the years. Here is my conversation with Helen Simard.
I was spokesperson, what year was that? I think that was 2019. That was the last festival we got to do in person. Yeah, I had the honor of being the spokesperson of the Montreal Fringe Festival.
They chose a good one for that final year. And you've held many roles too at the festival, because you've been an artist and you've overseen work, but you've also been managing things as well, being a spokesperson. What was your favorite role?
I mean, I've been involved with the Fringe Festival since 2000, I guess, as a spectator, as an artist, as a volunteer, as an employee of the festival. I managed the 13th hour venue for 2 years, 3 years maybe even, and also worked box office. I've been a super fan. I am a friend of the Fringe and a donor. And I think, you know, my favorite, it's hard to say that there's one role that's a favorite role, because I think what's beautiful about Fringe is that it gives a chance to people to participate in live performance in so many different ways. So you're not just an artist or just a spectator. You have the chance to blur back and forth between these roles and appreciate the festival from all sides.
I'm curious to know about what your first experience was like. I think you said that you were a spectator at first.
Yes.
How can you say?
2000. Well, in 2000, I tried to see a show and it was sold out. And that's, you know, it was a friend's show and he was like, come by my show, but make sure you get there early. I was like, oh yeah, whatever. There's a lot of seats. It'll be fine. And so kind of was really struck in that first year about how, oh, you have to really book in advance sometimes and really make plans. This was, you know, before everything was online. So you had to show up and line up 2 hours before a show to get a ticket, often if it was one of the popular ones. Then, you know, myself participated as an artist with a group that was called Solid State. And we did a show that was called Showdown, that was a hip hop, b-girling, contemporary dance, kind of physical theater performance. And then it was exciting because then we got to be those artists with that big lineup that was around the block. And sold out shows and a lot of hype, a lot of excitement around your performance. So I really got bitten by the Fringe bug. And I think I've performed at the Montreal Fringe. I've presented work 6 times, I think, over the years. And I've also toured and done Fringe shows in Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg. So I'd say I'm pretty fringy through and through.
I think pretty fringy is an excellent way to describe it. What was that feeling first like when you, because your first experience was in seeing how hotly popular a show could be, the first time you had that lineup around the block with Solid State, like what went through your mind?
I mean, it was just so exciting. It was mind-blowing. We were young artists, a young group of dancers, just out of university, kind of doing our first real big production. And I mean, I think it was exciting for me because in dance in Canada, there's not that many dance festivals. And so when you're a young artist and you're just starting out, it was kind of most immediate, most direct ways that we could access touring across the country. And so I feel like Fringe really taught me how to hustle. Fringe taught me how to be really open to engaging with spectators. And Fringe taught me that, you know, with a couple dollars and a lot of conviction, you can make magic. And that's what I love about it.
I wanted to note the first show that you worked on, you weren't the director or involved creatively beyond performing, I think is what I understood, with Solid State, but that drew inspiration from a Bach cello suite. And in your more recent works, Dark Side of the Dance Side of the Moon was hardcore Pink Floyd. You've done a ton of work with inspired by Iggy Pop's oeuvre. And I'm just curious to know about how your relationship to music and using that as an inspiration and starting off point has evolved in tandem with your time at Fringe.
Yeah. So, I mean, music has always been super important to me. I would say that as an art consumer, music is probably the art form that I consume most often and most ravenously. I love music. I love concerts. I have bands that I've been following, you know, my entire life that I'm still in love with. And I think, you know, growing up in a smaller town, I'm from Kingston, Ontario, and I also lived in even smaller villages at different points in my life. We didn't always have access to contemporary dance performance. You know, I had only ever seen one contemporary dance show in my life before moving to Montreal. I'd seen a lot of ballet and musicals, but you know, the access to art that I mainly had was through music. And the access that I had to dance was through music videos, primarily when I was a younger artist. And so I think that my choreographic approach has always been inspired by the relationship between music and dance. And in contemporary practices and stage dance, you know, there was a certain point in history where dance and music decided to divorce each other, and dance wanted to insist that it was its own art form that wasn't just, you know, serving music as decoration. And that's something that was really important to happen at a certain point in dance history. But for me, the pleasure of creating dance, of watching dance, of dancing comes from a love of music. And so I've always taken music, musical works, musicians as sources of inspiration. And I also think that for a spectator who maybe knows less about contemporary dance practice, music is a much easier entry point into being exposed to a new art form. Many more people have a relationship to music, I think, than to contemporary dance. And so for me, by working with musicians or with, you know, known musical works, it's kind of gives people an entry point or a doorway into a work that maybe they might find intimidating otherwise. And it allows people to, you know, when we did Dance Side of the Moon, it was a really important discussion that kept coming up, that we were like, people have a stronger emotional relationship with the album Dark Side of the Moon than they will ever have to our show. And so we have to create a show that makes space for that nostalgia and that sense of connection to a musical work. And we have to make a show that allows spectators to go into their own dreams and their own imagination and their own relationship to that music. So it's never a question of illustrating or demonstrating music on stage, but for me, it's really, a fascination, a lifelong fascination with the musicality of the dancing body and how the dancing body communicates with music and puts it into physical form.
Thank you so much, Helen, for taking the time to speak with us about your Fringe experience, because it's much appreciated.
Of course, and I'm excited that we're going forward this year. You know, we have to keep creating, we have to keep supporting, we have to keep coming together, even in strange times, even with masks on. Art is really an essential service, and it's so necessary to have these moments of joy in these strange times.
Choreographer Ellen Simard on the many hats she has worn at the Fringe Festival. I'm Sarah Day, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, a special show featuring excerpts from Le Lab Fringe Buzz, a podcast created last year by the folks at the Montreal Fringe Festival. I co-hosted the series, and tonight we are airing conversations from those episodes. My final interview is with Pat Donnelly, who spent 31 years as an arts journalist at the Montreal Gazette, covering every Fringe since 1991 when the festival first started. Pat was wearing a Fringe t-shirt when we spoke on Zoom, and she told me all about what the Fringe spirit means to her and described the evolution of the festival through her eyes.
Hi, I'm Pat Donnelly, and for 31 years, I wrote for the Montreal Gazette. And most of that time, 25 of those years, I covered the theater beat. The other six was books and literary things. So during those years, and even during the time I was supposed to be doing the book beat, I always went to the Fringe. So I am ready to Fringe. I got my sun hat on. I have my sunglasses handy. And my water bottle over there, and my 1991 Fringe Festival t-shirt, which is from the very first Fringe.
Tell me what the 1991 Fringe Festival was like, because we're hearing kind of tales about shoestring budgets and, you know, a tent going up in a parking lot. It really sounds like it was a DIY experience.
Do not think for a moment there was any support for this in 1991. I don't recall they got any funding, but maybe they, but certainly not official, you know, no significant amount from any government body, that's for sure. They were young people, Chris, Nick, Kieran, and Nick Mora, who were students at McGill, who were from Edmonton. They knew how important fringes were because the Edmonton Fringe Festival had begun several years before, and it was based on the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which actually began in 1947, before I was even born. So they knew how important it was, and they were involved in the McGill theater scene. And because I had been a student at McGill and very involved in the theater there at one point, I identified with these kids, so I went the extra mile for them. I fought to get coverage into the paper. I encouraged people at the Gazette to sponsor the event, and they did for many years. They sponsored the event, and I told them I thought it was the most exciting thing to happen on the English theater scene that since I had been following it.
The shows themselves in 1991, were they good?
There were always people who were very good who showed up at the Fringe, and my story of my biggest regret at the Fringe is that I don't know if it was 1991. It was one of those very early years. And you know how you get when you're covering the Fringe, you're looking at your program, it's 9 o'clock at night and you got to choose a show. And I was looking at my program and I saw two shows. There was a local one and I maybe knew somebody in the cast. And then there was one, there was a group of comedians from Florida. I knew nothing about them. And I thought, my thing is giving the locals a chance. So I went to the local show, which was not great. And I found out afterwards I missed a troupe of people that included a young comedian named Stephen Colbert. You know, and of course, he wasn't big at that time. He was just a budding young comedian. And we only figured out later, hey, he was here.
I'm curious about your experience as a critic, because having positive review in the Montreal Gazette after the first weekend of the Fringe could be huge for a show, especially for someone from out of town or a newcomer. But how did that frame how you experienced the festival? You know, I'm imagining that, number one, it's a lot of work because you're seeing a ton of shows at once, right? But, you know, did artists... in such an intimate space, you know, did artists see you coming in and go, oh my gosh, that's Pat Donnelly? What is the Pat Donnelly experience?
Complicated. I wasn't the only media there. I had a colleague from the Winnipeg Fringe, he worked for the Winnipeg newspaper, and many of the Cross Canada shows did the circuit. So he would get the jump on the Winnipeg coverage by coming here and taking in all the shows that traveled across Canada. Now that guy was big stuff to me, you know? And of course there were, in those days, it's hard for you to remember, Sarah, you were so young, but we had two alternative newspapers here, English ones, Hour and the Mirror. And they didn't pay anybody anything, but sometimes they would get all these enthusiast people. So who got the competition was who covered the most shows, how quickly, you know? And of course, because they were a weekly, they only had they had two shots at it. And for me, the pressure was on the first to me. And I just developed this methodology for the Fringe, which is you got to jump on it and hit it the first weekend and don't even think about the overtime, which you will never get paid by anyway, but just jump on it and see how many shows you can see the first weekend that you can write about in the Monday paper. And then I had a freelance helper who was Janet Coots, and she was the most devoted person. We would both hit the weekend, I do a little article for the Monday, but I wouldn't do a roundup. And she'd do a roundup for the Monday, and my roundup would go in Tuesday. And then in later years, we had, because it was a strong dance element, so then we had a dance critic who would also do the same thing. And she would jump on the first weekend, and she would maybe file the story for Wednesday with her roundup. And of course, then we had Bill Brownstein, who was a columnist who got the easy job. He didn't have to go to any of the shows. He just had to hang around the tent and find somebody who was a good interview. And he'd get his story done before anybody else. So his story would get the big play on the front page. And all the rest of us who were out there schlepping from venue to venue, our stories would end up on the third page, and you know. So he never got into the intense running to venue like we did, because his job was different, and he did a great job. He's very witty, and he did great interviews. But the rest of us, it was only in the second week that we could start doing interviews, and then we just tacked the reviews on to the end of the interview.
Do you think the theater scene needs, back then, I think when it started, we definitely needed something like this to inject something into the theater scene, but we still need it today?
Oh, yes. It became a very important first try for so many theater students out of Dawson, John Abbott, National Theater School. We have so many theater schools here. And what was interesting that was these groups got big houses right from the start, because they had friends and family in the city, where the out-of-towners had to prove they were good before they got a following, you know? But it certainly gave people their first chance to try to put on a show. And I think it was particularly good for playwrights. What kept me going a lot of the time was the innovative but never quite finished writing. You know, it never quite edited, never should have been directed, never directed. So many mavericks, fringes are inhabited by mavericks. But the creativity of it and just the miracle of the putting on the show. And I saw shows that so much imagination, you know? It opened your eyes to a lot of things. Now, it also formed, and this was early, this is in the 1990s, and we're talking early days. I saw many of my first coming out plays there. And then eventually so many, it became a genre on its own. So it has always been a safe place for LGBTQ community. So as a kind of a mini society, you know, everybody loves the drag races. Everybody loves Meadow. Everybody, you know, went to all these shows and came to, I think, a better understanding of what it meant to be LGBTQ, you know? And I think in that sense, it made a wonderful contribution. And later years, for the 20th anniversary, I interviewed Amy, and she was still regretted that the audiences were not diverse. But the actual shows were becoming more culturally diverse, you know? And so, again, opening up to more communities and bringing them together in the beer tent.
Oh man, we could keep talking to you for ages, I think, because you're such a repository with so many interesting stories. So thank you so much for giving us even just a glimpse into that.
And thank you for inviting me, and we'll see you at the Fringe.
That was Pat Donnelly, longtime Montreal Gazette theater critic. Before I go this evening, I'll leave you with a short story. Rick Miller premiered his own show, Mac Homer, at the Fringe in 1996. It would go on to tour the world and be a massive hit. But first, he had to convince his skeptical mother that the theater was where he belonged.
So So my memory of the Montreal Fringe is, these are the early days of the Fringe. This is 1995. And I had just played Murderer Number 2 in a production of Repercussion Theater's, well, Shakespeare in the Park, Macbeth at the time. And I had created this cast party joke. And this was going to be my big premiere at the Fringe. And I had just graduated with 2 degrees in architecture. And so my mother thought I was completely insane to think that I was going to actually not only be working for free in Shakespeare, but then do the Fringe. She had no idea what this thing was. She saw the show. It was in the Shatner building. It was, you know, little theater and like very low tech, 2 slide projectors, but a lot of creativity, a lot of ideas. I had a bunch of collaborators, but it was pretty much all me on stage. She saw the show and she said, okay, I get it. I get it. I hear what you want to do. You don't want to make buildings. You want to make theater. Go for it. You have my blessing. Ish.
You have been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. The guests you heard this evening, writer Marie Barlizzo and performer Julie Tamiko Manning, comedian and host Chana Wintour, choreographer Ellen Samard, and journalist Pat Donnelly, uncovering the early days of the festival. And you heard right at the end there, performer Rick Miller. And since we heard...
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
And welcome to the January 27th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show, we're presenting an alternative radio classic entitled Intellectuals, Ideology, and the State. It was recorded in Cambridge, Massachusetts on October 16th, 1998. The lecturer is Iqbal Ahmed. He was a professor emeritus of international relations and Middle Eastern studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He had an extraordinary life. He was born in Irkir, Bahir, to an Indian Muslim landowning family. His father was murdered because he was parceling out land to peasants. Upon the partition of India in 1947, he went to Pakistan. He came to the U.S. to attend Princeton. He was in Algeria during the revolt against French rule. For many years, he was managing editor of Race and Class. His articles and essays appeared in The Nation and other journals throughout the world. He was a close ally of Edward Said, Noam Chomsky, and Howard Zinn. Edward Said called him an intellectual unintimidated by power or authority. Confronting Empire and Terrorism, Theirs and Ours are the two books he did with David Barsamian. Iqbal Ahmed.